Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNC 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network, and it's a great pleasure to welcome the author, Josh Rogan, of The Washington Post. He is a journalist as well, writes the Global Opinions column for The Post, but now the author, Josh Rogan, to congratulate him for his new book, Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. The book is a story of the Trump administration evolving policy with the People's Republic of China. It is also the story right now of the evolving policy of new administrations ad infinitum, Mr. Biden's and whatever follows. We begin, however, with something that one of the principals in the book, Matthew Pottinger, at one time Deputy National Security Advisor, Colonel Matthew Pottinger of the U.S. Marine Corps, retired, quoted in the course of the descriptions of the evolving policy of the Trump administration. This is from Confucius, from the Analects. I read the English translation. If names cannot be correct, then language cannot be in accordance with the truth of things. And if language cannot be in accordance with the truth of things, then affairs cannot be carried on to success. Josh, a very good evening to you. Congratulations. And the Confucius quote identifies to me, a reader of irony, that the relationship between Washington and Beijing, between the capitalist republic of the United States and the communist authoritarian regime of China, is a search for the names of things and the truth of things. We begin with a date you make much help with in 2016. It's November 1st, 2016, at the Palace Hotel. Present is a man named Yang, representing the People's Republic of China. Opposite him on this date are the then Secretary of State, John Kerry, and the then National Security Advisor, Susan Rice. That day, what was the relationship between the outgoing Obama administration and Xi Jinping, the President for Life of China? Good evening to you, Josh.
Well, good evening to you, John. As you point out, one of the main thrusts of the Trump administration's reorientation of U.S. policy on China was, as Matthew Pottinger often said, to inject candor and reciprocity into the relationship. In other words, the premise was that denying or hiding or massaging or lying about what was going on in the relationship, especially what was going on the Chinese side of the relationship, had not served us well, had not served the relationship well, and had led both the U.S. and China into a situation where both were able to sort of talk past each other in a way where hard problems were never resolved, not even really discussed, much less in out in the open. And this was the prevailing bipartisan approach for much of the last 40 years. And the meeting that you talk about, which was 1 week before the 2016 election, where top Obama administration officials invited top Chinese government officials to the Palace Hotel in New York, was supposed to be a scene setter for the incoming Hillary Clinton administration. It was supposed to be a handoff meeting where Rice and Kerry basically said to Yang Jishi and the other Chinese diplomats assembled, the relationship is going well. It's going to get better. We need to make sure it keeps getting better. And as long as we both have that in our minds, everything's going to be fine. Now, that looking back, that seems a little odd and funny for a couple of different reasons. One is because, of course, the relationship wasn't going very well. Even at that time, even in late 2016, there were plenty of indications and lots of concern, both inside and outside the U.S. government, that the rise of China under Xi Jinping had taken a decidedly more authoritarian turn and towards internal repression and external aggression and interference in our free and open societies in ways that we didn't like and that we couldn't tolerate. And the message that the Obama administration officials were sending was quite different than that. It was simply that, you know, ignore all of those concerns. We're going to make sure everything's fine, and we're going to have smooth sailing as long as we can keep the tone of the relationship positive. The other funny thing about that meeting looking back is that, of course, Hillary Clinton didn't win the 2016 election. And when Donald Trump was elected president of the United States exactly 1 week later, this shocked not only Americans, but people around the world, including the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party, who had just been reassured only a week earlier that everything was going to be fine, that Hillary Clinton was going to win, and the relationship was going to continue on its relatively smooth trajectory. So you can just imagine how this sort of threw all of the assumptions that were that the Chinese side was basing its approach to the United States on into total chaos, right? And of course, then the Chinese leadership had to decide, how do we deal with this president, Donald Trump? Who's advising him? Who's in charge of his policy? What does he think? What is his campaign rhetoric, which was very anti-China and very anti-Beijing? Is that going to be the new U.S. foreign policy going forward? And what the book lays out is that, in fact, they got two different, totally contradictory messages. On the one hand, Henry Kissinger was dispatched quickly to Beijing with a message directly from the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to tell the Chinese leadership, don't worry, everything will be fine. And we want continued constructive relations based on mutual respect, win-win cooperation, and all the rest. At the same exact time, on the same exact day, the president-elect Donald Trump took a phone call from the Taiwanese president, Tsai Ing-wen. And as the book describes, the reason he took this phone call is because he didn't understand what he was doing, and his staff had essentially given him the phone call to make without explaining to him that this was going to be a break in 40 years of U.S. policy towards China. And, of course, the phone call resulted in a huge controversy, and the people in Beijing were very confused. So they dispatched the same exact diplomat, Yang Jishir, back to New York to go meet with Trump's officials in Jared Kushner's family's
December 9th, 2016, yes, approximately 5 weeks after the meeting between Kerry, Rice, and Yang. And he delivered a message that is written in stone, that China would not tolerate, will not accept anything but the obedience to its territorial integrity. They more than drew a line in the sand. They drew a line in the ocean. They drew a line through Eurasia. And they were very blunt. They named the thing itself. That's what's so striking about this, Josh. China said right away what was important. And it was some time before the U.S. listened.
That's exactly right. Yang Jishir was dispatched to New York to scold the incoming Trump administration. How dare you upend 40 years of U.S.-China relations? How dare you take a call from Tsai Ing-wen? And the quote that Yang said was, the territorial integrity of China must not be questioned. In other words, he was directing his American interlocutors to shut up about Tibet, Taiwan, Hong Kong, the Uyghurs, you name it, anything that the Chinese Communist Party defines as part of its core interests. Now, of course, that was the beginning of this very confusing, complicated, fractious relationship between the Trump administration and the Chinese leadership, and that's what the book traces. But here we are exactly 4 years after that, and we have a new administration, and who do the Chinese send to Alaska to meet with the new Biden administration, but the same exact figure, Yang Jishir.
It's a wonderful economy of scenes, Josh. Yang is the man for all seasons. They send him to the Obama team. They send him to the Trump team. They send him to the Biden team. This is the man
and
who
he
gives
comes
us
with essentially the same exact message,
yes,
which is,
yes,
you guys better shut up.
Right.
About the Uyghurs and Taiwan and Tibet and Hong Kong and all the rest. And yes, and then, but the thing that was different about this time around is that they did it in public. You know, all this time, the Chinese messages had been different in public and private. And now the public message is very similar to what Yang Jishir has been saying to American leaders for all of these years, which is that this is not China rising. This is a China risen. And we don't want to hear any more of your criticism. And we will criticize you back as much as we want. And, you know, if you Americans want a Cold War, then you can go ahead and keep saying the things that you're saying, but you better not do it. And that is exactly what we heard from Yang Jishir in Alaska. And I think to the Biden administration, to its credit, pushed back on that and said, no, we're going to say what we think. We're going to defend our interests. We're going to stand up for our values. And if you don't like it, tough. And in a way, they're adopting Pottinger's edict. Which
well,
is
let's we get on. Let's get on to the evolving of the Pottinger observations. The book is Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. Josh Rogan is the author. When we come back, Cake and cruise missiles at Mar-a-Lago with Xi Jinping. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. Continuing my conversation with the author Josh Rogan of The Washington Post, his new book, Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. This is a careful explication of the evolving Trump administration policy towards China. It is also an examination of China's understanding or lack of how the U.S. works over the course of our 2.5 centuries. We're a very young nation compared to the Middle Kingdom. Very, very young. And our explanations of ourselves do not necessarily make sense or make clear sense to the Chinese. The Chinese begin the Trump administration by naming the thing itself. Our territorial integrity, our sovereignty must not be questioned. And of course, that's what the Trump people did for 4 years, and the U.S. will continue. However, we go to Mar-a-Lago, a wonderful scene that will someday be in an opera. Donald Trump is serving his chocolate cake to Xi Jinping in a celebratory mood, and he delivers the message that he's just ordered cruise missiles fired on Syria. At least that's the legend. I'll go with it, because the question here is, what are the forces within the Trump administration that early date that are pulling and pushing the development of the China policy? We need personalities here. Now, Josh, you made clear that it's not clear that everybody's in one camp or another. They move back and forth. But I'm going to seize on Plan A. That's Gary Cohn, Steve Mnuchin, and the Wall Street Gang. What do they tell the president at that time, early on in 2017?
Right. Well, you have to remember that Donald Trump campaigned on a message of economic nationalism, promising to get our jobs back from China and to stop the Chinese government from screwing over the United States economy, and he used some very heated rhetoric. But when he became president, the policy was actually handed over to the Wall Street guys, Gary Cohn, Steve Mnuchin, and to an extent, Wilbur Ross. Now, they wanted a totally different policy. They wanted to make a trade deal, and they wanted to make it quick. And what better way to do that than to invite Xi Jinping to Mar-a-Lago and get everybody around the table, eat some chocolate cake, and work it out. So that was who was in control of the policy at Mar-a-Lago. Now, you had these other people from the campaign like Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller and Peter Navarro and to an extent Matt Pottinger, who were very wary of all of these deals, and they didn't want to get roped back into these comprehensive economic dialogues that the Chinese government loves, because it allows you to just talk and talk about the problem without solving it for years and years. But they didn't have the ball. They didn't have the president's blessing or his attention at that point. So they decided to sit back and let the Wall Street guys try to do this. And they figured that the Chinese government would just screw around with them and would never really give them a good deal that they could bring to the president. And that's, of course, what happened. And Mar-a-Lago is the scene where all of this begins, where Gary Cohn makes a presentation at the end to a room full of Trump administration officials in the garden room in the back of the club. And he says to them, listen, we're going to enter into these strategic and economic dialogues, comprehensive this and that, and we're going to have 100 days of negotiations, and it's going to be wonderful. And then Trump calls Navarro from the back of the room, and you have to remember, Navarro was excluded from all of these negotiations quite intentionally by Mnuchin and Cohn. And Navarro says, what are we, crazy? What are we, stupid? We're going to do the same thing that everyone else did and put a different name on it and expect it to be changed. He's like, "We." And, of course, Trump looks at that, and he says, aha, maybe Navarro's got something right here. So what that was the beginning of Trump's policy to essentially let the Wall Street guys try to make a quick deal with China, but have a backup plan. And that backup plan was what Pottinger and Navarro and Bannon were pushing, which was the trade war, which eventually became the tech war. And that's exactly how it played out. Mnuchin and Ross tried their best to get the Chinese to agree to a quick deal. The Chinese government never gave them anything good. They failed. And then Trump turned to the hardliners and the trade war began.
The personalities here, again, if this is an opera, we introduce them one at a time with significant hairstyles. Matt Pottinger is the Deputy National Security Advisor. Peter Navarro has a rolling title that has to do with trade. Steve Mnuchin is the Secretary of the Treasury. Gary Cohn is the head of the National Economics Council at the time. There's another player to enter in here because, as Josh says, these lines of contention did not develop logically or neatly. That would be Christopher Wray, the new director of the FBI, who warns that this is a whole of society threat. That was very early, Josh, that the FBI had picked up that there was a common purpose to these random, apparently random, espionage or surveillance, misleading statements by Chinese nationals or people who were living, traveling in this country about China and intellectual property and other purloining pursuits. So everybody had different evidence of what was going on. Let's focus on what you said. And Peter Navarro, by the way, was prominent in the Trump campaign. Donald Trump picked him out early on because of a movie he did, a film he did called Death by China. That's Peter Navarro. Right. Death by China. That's why Trump picked him to be his trade representative about China. That's his job. Now, developing here is this China policy, and it's the evolving nature of it is led by Matt Pottinger and an Australian named John Garneau. What do we need to know about him, Matt? Because that was new to me.
Right. So as you described, there weren't just two camps. There were several teams, and the teams changed over time because there was so much turnover. And in a way, the campaign folks and some of the real super hawks, the people who really wanted to bring down the CCP, like Bannon and Navarro, they had an alliance with hardliners. That's national security types like Matt Pottinger and, to an extent, Christopher Wray, who don't want to blow up the relationship, but they do want to have a tougher policy to confront the Chinese government's bad actions. And so they work together at some points in the story, especially against the Wall Street clique and Steve Mnuchin and Gary Cohn and later Larry Kudlow, right, who they saw as promoting pro-Beijing interests in the interests of integration, which is not what they were trying to do. Now, that all that means is that while the trade people were operating on a certain political level, in between the news, underneath the system, two levels down, there were a lot of other interesting things going on, and they were connected at times to the top level politics in unpredictable and fascinating ways. And that's what the book tries to do. It tries to link what was going on inside of our government to what we saw on our TV screens. And those two things were not linked in the way that you would think. And when it came to trade, it was very interesting because what Pottinger did was he brought in the top Australian experts on Chinese influence operations, including a former journalist named John Garneau. And what they did was they traced the history of Chinese influence operations inside of all parts of Australian society. And that means academia and Wall Street and money into their politics and their research institutions and you name it. And then they applied what they had been learned in over 10 years of research in Australia to the American system and tried to have a better understanding of where the Chinese Communist Party was using its influence operations to interfere in our society. And that was proven to be very useful for people like Christopher Wray, who were trying to take the resources of the federal government and point them more towards the China challenge and away from some of the other things that they had been working on. Now, was Trump aware of all of this? Not really. You know, he was focused more on the trade stuff. And, you know, are we going to have soybean, you know, sales? And what, you know, are they going to sell beef to China? And those are not, I'm not saying those are not important things, but, you know, that's what the majority of the media was pointed at. But really, the real changes that were going on in 2018 were beneath the surface, and they were quite intentional, but they would only really be seen much later on in the story.
The book is Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. The author is Josh Rogan of The Washington Post. 2017 ends with Donald Trump traveling to Asia and in looking for deals with China. One deal, of course, would be to involve a shipment of fossil fuels, West Virginia fracking. However, 2018 is going to turn the story in a completely surprising direction. When we come back, the Bingo Club. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, continuing with Josh Rogan, the author of the new book, Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. 2017 sets the scale of the operation for the Trump administration. We have competing factions within, large personalities. 2017 ends with Donald Trump traveling to Asia, the APEC meeting, acknowledging that Xi is president for life of the People's Republic of China, and also mixing in the fact that Wall Street has ambitions to continue to invest and profit in China. It's a giant market. However, now we have to introduce something I learned about for the first time in Josh's book, the Bingo Club. Josh, what is the Bingo Club?
The Bingo Club was a group of government officials, congressional staffers, experts, and even a couple of journalists who met secretly in Washington beginning in 2017 and 2018 to discuss Chinese malign foreign influence and interference in American politics and in American society. And this is an issue that in 2021 we talk about quite openly, but in that time and space, it was something that no part of the U.S. government was pointed at and that nobody was really discussing in public. And because of that, this group had a huge influence on not only how the U.S. government operated when looking for and then dealing with instances of Chinese Communist Party interference and influence operations, but it also had a big sort of impact on sort of how those issues eventually spilled out into various parts of our policy, especially in Congress. And, you know, the fact that that group had to meet in secret just tells you about sort of what the discussion about U.S. and China was in our public discourse at that time. And it was really, you know, seen as difficult to talk about because it's designed to be difficult to talk about. What we're talking about is the Chinese Communist Party's United Front. And what is that? Well, that's the multi-billion-dollar organization that they have to sponsor all over the world projects that operate in the space between overt propaganda, the kind of stuff you see every day, and secret espionage, which is the kind of stuff that all countries do. In that middle space are actions that are seemingly public but conceal a covert purpose. In other words, when you see a Confucius Institute at an American university, well, is that malign or is that just people learning Chinese? And the answer is that sometimes it's one and sometimes it's the other. And because that's a very difficult thing to sort of wrap your head around, first, the community of experts had to come together to figure out how to talk about it amongst themselves before they could start to explain it to the rest of the country.
There are personalities to mention here, Josh, because it's easy to remember them. Jack Ma, described as the richest man in China, maybe the world at some point, depending on Alibaba and his other enterprises, was fresh face in America, traveling to great applause. I remember news that he bought a large piece of New York State. He was buying real estate at the time. And the then Mrs. Murdoch, Wendy Dong Murdoch, was a large personality as well, although that marriage ended in 20, it eventually ended. The fact is that her presence suggested that China was integrating into American culture. Also, we have the story of Elaine Chao, who is married to Mitch McConnell, then majority leader of the United States Senate, Republican. And I seize on the Chao story, which you tell very succinctly, because it is difficult to tell whether this is right. Chinese influence or whether it's just good old government, because Elaine Chao's family is a respected and prominent Taiwanese family, and her father is a shipping magnate. Please explain, Josh, how hard it is to tell whether it's the mainland or Taiwan or just good old-fashioned government.
Right. The Chao story is an especially interesting one because this is a Chinese, Taiwanese, and American success story. It's really the only family to really be royalty in all three of those communities. And the story is that Elaine Chao's father, you know, escaped China with a lot of the KMT nationalists when they lost to the communists. And that's how they got to Taiwan, where Elaine Chao was born. And then they eventually moved to America, became American citizens. And when China opened up, the Chaos went back to China and did a lot of amazingly successful business there and became very, very rich. Now, none of that is wrong in of itself. What the problem was that when Elaine Chao became transportation secretary, she spent vast amounts of time, doing Chinese media, trying to arrange trips for her family to China, and mixing her father's business with her official responsibilities while totally ignoring the U.S. press. And totally, you know, and the allegation was that she was abusing her position to help her family's business, which is not necessarily a Chinese influence problem. It's just a basic corruption allegation. But it just so happens that her business is heavily tied to all of these Chinese state-run companies. Her sister is on the board of the Bank of China, et cetera. So, in other words, you know, we have to be very careful before accusing anyone, especially Chinese Americans, of working on behalf of a foreign government. At the same time, it's very clear that the Chow family was mixing its business interests with Elaine Chao's public business in a way that they were trying to hide from the American people, and that's not okay. So that's about as complicated as a story as you can get. And then when you look at the rest of what the Trumps were doing on that Asia trip that you talk about, well, they, you know, Jared's sister was selling visas, basically, by encouraging people to pay money to get access to the American visas in China. You know, that's not okay. That's under investigation. You know, Jared Kushner tried to get the head of Ong Bong Insurance Company to bail him out of a real estate problem. That's not okay, right? And then that guy got arrested and sent to prison for 18 years. Ivanka Trump was constantly getting trademark approvals in China at various points in the trade negotiations. Now, was there a quid pro quo? I haven't seen evidence of that. But at the same time, every time there was a tough trade negotiation, somehow Ivanka Trump would get a bunch of trademarks approved. That's not okay. So the mixing and corrupting of elites is part of the CCP's broad effort. And they don't just do it for people who are in power. That's why,
let's go to Montana. Let's go to Montana, Josh. Okay. Steve Daines, sure. Then our congressman from Montana, with an ambition for his constituents. They're cattlemen. They want to sell beef to China. It is not clear to me that he understands that he's being influenced. Along with him, the staffers of Capitol Hill who are taking on junkets to China. It's not clear to me that they understand they're being influenced. Or am I too naive about this, Josh? Do they all wink about it?
You know, Steve Daines, the senator from Montana, he should know better. He did business in China for many years while working as an executive for Procter Gamble. He knows what he's doing when he invites the Chinese ambassador to a Montana ranch and tries to get a beef deal done. And then the ambassador calls a couple months later and says, hey, can you host these officials from Tibet who are going to deny the atrocities in Tibet, and we're going to take that denial in your picture and plaster it all over Chinese propaganda media? That's exactly what happened, you know. And that's not is that a quid pro quo? Not exactly. It's a relationship that Steve Daines built up. And, yes, I do believe he did know better when he hosted that meeting of CCP officials in the Capitol building, and the Chinese media blared out, U.S. senator says everything in Tibet is hunky-dory. You know, that's him being used as a tool of Chinese Communist Party propaganda in exchange for a beef deal. And I think if he didn't know that, he should have. Now, the staff assistant who works at your congressman's office, who gets offered a 5-star trip to Xinjiang to go hang out with the Uyghurs who love Xi Jinping and who tell them that everything's beautiful and everything's great in Xinjiang, that staffer probably doesn't know what's going on. That staffer was probably, in fact, chosen because they don't know what's going on. And that just shows you the scope and scale of the influence effort. So throw money at a U.S. senator or a lowly staff assistant and everyone in between, because that's how the United Front works. They shoot 1,000 bullets to see what will hit. And, you know, that they develop these relationships over time. So that's just something that we started to become aware of in 2018, but we haven't, even in 2021, really even scratched the surface of.
Yes, the challenge always is that Confucius quote, to name correctly what the thing is. Is it China? Is it money? Is it Wall Street? You can't tell. We're going to turn to someone, Robert Lighthizer, the trade representative, who named things specifically in February, March, and April of 2018 about the trade war that will quickly become the tech war. Josh Rogan. The book is Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. Josh Rogan, the Washington Post columnist, his new book, Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century, the story of the Trump administration's evolving policy towards China, always double track, triple track, doubling back, never straightforward. But an event, February of 2018, March of 2018, Robert Lighthizer, the trade representative. Josh, what was the Lighthizer report? What is a 301 investigation?
Well, in early 2018, the Wall Street guys had lost their chance to make a quick deal, and Trump had turned to his national security people to say, we need to raise the pressure on Beijing, and we need to come up with some tariffs. And the mechanics of that were handed over to U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, extensive experience in this area. And what he did was he compiled the most devastating report, government report to date, about China's illicit trade practices. We're talking about unfair subsidies and intellectual property theft and all economic espionage, economic aggression of all kinds. And that was the 301 report. And what that does is that forms the basis of the tariffs that the Trump administration would impose that still remain to this day, by the way. Now, Robert Lighthizer was an interesting figure because he wasn't a super hawk. He wasn't aligned with Bannon or Navarro, but he wasn't a Wall Street clique guy either. He wasn't friends with Steve Mnuchin. He was a trade guy, a trade hawk, you could say, but one that was focused on these very specific issues. And of course, once he had put forth this report, you know, that accused China of all of these, I would say rightly accused China of all of these transgressions, that became the bar. That became the thing that the Chinese government had to address. And that had two big effects. One is that, you know, they couldn't really address it, you know, in the sense they were, we were asking at that point China to change its entire industrial policy and to stop its entire industrial, you know, strategy. And there's an argument that they were never going to do that anyway. But it also, so that meant the trade war would move forward. But it also meant that when they actually struck the deal at the end, that this was, again, Lighthizer back in the pole position. But we can get to that a little bit later.
The trade negotiation at this point has tariffs, has sanctions talk. There's sanctions talk. But what we're looking at is theft, IP theft, straight up theft. And the estimate in 2018, early 2018, was $50 billion annually. I'm sure it's much higher now. At the same time, the Trump administration is developing a national security strategy. Josh, what was the significance? Mike Pompeo is now Secretary of State, early 2018. John Bolton is National Security Advisor. Matt Pottinger is his deputy. They develop what they call the Indo-Pacific Command. What's the significance of the name change? Why is the correct name important here?
Right. Well, you know, it goes back to what you said, calling things by their names. Because, you know, once we had the trade war had started, you know, this entire idea that you have to never speak of the bad things that the Chinese government are doing, lest they would, you know, cause a cold war or a conflict, or the whole relationship would just go kaflooey. That whole idea was put to rest. You know, and remember, there was very serious people making this argument, including people like Mnuchin, who said, "Oh well, we can't have tariffs. That will be the end of the relationship, and the Chinese will walk away." Well, as it turns out, that wasn't the case. Okay, and they stayed at the table and they kept negotiating. So now, all of a sudden, Trump and people around him realized that we could do two things at once. We could raise the pressure on China, and at the same time, still negotiate with them. So once that became obvious, the ceiling was lifted and a lot of other things could move forward, including on the national security front. So then you had a whole team of national security people who were like, oh, okay, well, what can we do with this new sort of space in our policy? And one of the things that they did was to, you know, make unveil something that Pottinger had been working on from day one, which was this idea of an Indo-Pacific strategy. And that was basically to take our Pacific strategy and add India to it, okay? And if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense because India is the biggest democracy in the world and the counterweight in that region that can really bring a lot of economic and military and other kinds of power to bear. Now, that didn't always go perfectly, right? There's a lot of points in the story where mistakes were made. But, you know, there's a question over whether or not we really ever devoted the resources to that plan. But what was going on in 2018 was that, okay, well, now the trade war was on, which in a sense, you know, had its own momentum. But meanwhile, the national security people started to really get organized. And it took them a while to get their boots on. But once they had done that, they started coming out with all of these new strategies, national defense strategy, Indo-Pacific strategy, national security strategy. And the conventional wisdom at the time was like, oh, just ignore that. No, Trump doesn't read it. Nobody cares what the strategy papers say. But the truth is that inside the government, people cared and people read them. And it did have an effect, although that effect was seen slowly over time.
October 2018, Mike Pence, Vice President of the United States at the Hudson Institute in Washington, identifying a twin problem with China. Josh has mentioned one of them, the United Front influence. Michael Pillsbury, by the way, a a China hand at the Trump administration, Josh reports, is in the front row. The second had to do with China retaliating, China interfering in American politics. How so, Josh? What did the vice president identify out loud? What did he name correctly?
Right. Well, you know, just the fact that the vice president of the United States was making a landmark speech in China was significant at that time. And no one at that level had made a speech to explain to the world what the Trump administration's China policy was. Now, it's also true that Trump didn't necessarily agree with everything that Mike Pence was saying at the Hudson Institute. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. The bottom line was that this was the clearest statement of the Trump administration's China strategy to date. And it was largely written by Matt Pottinger and another guy named Stephen Ford. And it's not a coincidence that Matt Pottinger was part of the Bingo Club. And he took many of those ideas and put them into Pence's speech. And all of a sudden, all of the things that all of these people had been discussing, especially Chinese influence and interference operations, were now coming out of the mouth of the vice president in public. And what was funny about that is that, well, not funny, but more ironic funny is that, you know, Mike Pence then went on a tour of Asia, and I joined him on that tour. We went to several countries to explain to our allies and partners and to meet with the Chinese to roll out this new idea that America was going to confront Chinese influence and interference operations and have this robust strategy and all the rest. And right after that tour, President Trump met with Xi Jinping at Buenos Aires at the G20 and undermined the entire thing. And according to John Bolton's book, told him that it would be totally fine if he wanted to put the Uyghurs in the camps, that it was the right thing to do, and basically, you know, confused everybody even more. So this was at once a statement of clarity, but that was quickly overtaken by the events, and those events were, the bumbling of the president himself.
So on the one hand, Mike Pence, the vice president, says, Beijing, the stalling game, we get it, it's over. No more stalling, no more promises. On the other hand, the president says, we're not bothered by internal affairs. We want to make a trade deal. And then the twist, putting both together. John Bolton is apprised that there's going to be a detention in Vancouver the next day. John Bolton, the National Security Advisor. He chooses not to tell the president about this. Who is detained and what is the significance of this, the economic war and the tech war and the national security war all colliding?
Right, right. So there they are, the presidents of the United States and China sitting at the dinner table discussing the trade war. And the president of the United States is not informed that the Canadians are about to arrest the CFO of Huawei, Ms. Meng, at the behest of the U.S. Justice Department. And John Bolton says in his book, well, he didn't want to bother the president about that at that time. But you can imagine that when the president found out that this had gone on during their dinner, he was very angry that he had been left out of the loop. And this is sort of the perfect, you know, Trump-China story, because it accurately brings to light sort of the chaos that was going on inside the administration. But in that chaos, there was intentionality, because as these national security officials were very worried that Trump was about to cut a bad deal, they were doing something that was actually going to make it harder for him to do that. And arresting the CFO of Huawei in the middle of a summit is a very controversial thing to do. And, you know, set aside whether or not she was guilty of the charges, you know, that was bound to have an effect on the relationship, but they did it anyway, and they didn't tell Trump. And then when he was very angry about it, it had the opposite effect of what he wanted, but it was too late. So the trade war and the tech war began under the most confusing sort of chaotic circumstances imaginable, and that set the stage for the next year of the U.S.-China competition, which only spiraled into more confusion in the midst of more competition.
Making a note here, Josh, though it's not the ambition of your book to also do Canadian evolving policies towards China, but immediately or soon after the detention of Ms. Meng, two Canadian citizens are detained and are still being held in China, what the Canadian government describes as hostage taking. So this was no longer just U.S.-China. It involved all of North America and a great deal of trade because of Canada's trade with China, an unsolved story. The Canadians need to name things too, Josh, not just the U.S.
Well, yes, and this is another example of the Trump administration shooting itself in the foot, because, of course, these countries, Canada, Europe, the frontline countries of Asia, are facing the same threats and the same challenges from China. We are.
Just a moment, Josh. We'll will continue in 2019. I'm sorry, I got too excited about your chronology. Josh Rogan, Washington Post, Chaos Under Heaven. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Josh Rogan, the Washington Post Global Opinions columnist, is also the author, Josh Rogan, of his new book, Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. 2017 is the two opponents, the United States and China, deciding whether how they're going to go forward between the hawks, the super hawks, Wall Street, those who want a diplomatic solution to what appears to be a trade imbalance to the new president, President Trump. 2018, there are definitions that are necessary. What is a economic war? What is a tech war? What is national security? The principles are moving around. There are no clear lines, as we learn from Josh's chronology of 17 and 18. It is now early 2019. The relationship is breaking down, and there's a search for metaphors. Recall that there's always a search for the right thing. This from a quote that Josh uses, thanks to Matt Pottinger in his book. If names cannot be correct, then language cannot be in accordance with the truth of things. And if language cannot be in accordance with the truth of things, then affairs cannot be carried on to success. The affairs between China and the United States are not clear at this point until you name the thing itself. Josh, is this a Cold War? Is that helpful in the year 2019 to think of it as a Cold War at the State Department and at the White House?
Thanks, John. You know, I argue in the book that the use of the term Cold War has been stretched beyond any real usefulness or any real constructive instruction on how we should think about what's going on between the U.S. and China. In short, it's been bastardized to the point of being totally misleading in the sense that what most people will tell you is that, oh, well, you know, we're headed towards a Cold War. We don't want a Cold War. Therefore, we should not confront Chinese government or any of its bad behavior. That's the typical Washington conventional wisdom. If you turn on your TV today or you listen to Henry Kissinger, that's the way that the term Cold War is used. And what I say in the book is that it's an imperfect analogy for a number of obvious reasons, but it's not a totally useless analogy. In other words, we're engaged in some sort of grand competition with China, and that's not just about, you know, soybeans and 5G. It's about ideology, and it's about politics, and it's about the world order, and it's about all of these fundamental things that we believe in and that our system and our order is based on. And we have to realize that the Chinese Communist Party just doesn't see it that way, and that they're trying to shape a world order that's more amenable to their interests. In other words, in a liberal world order where the things that they're doing are not confronted, including mass atrocities and all the rest. So, it's, you know, forget about the sort of, you know, false idea that a Cold War is something that we necessarily need to avoid or that this fits into that mold. It's useful in a sense in that we have a problem that's on the scope and the scale of the Cold War, but it's more of what I think people would refer to as a systems battle, right? And that systems battle is going to play out in a different way than it did with the Soviets. And of course, we're more integrated with China than we were with the Soviet Union. And of course, you know, this Cold War or systems battle or whatever you want to call it won't be primarily military. It won't be fought on military battlefields. It'll be fought in the economic, technological, and even ideological realms. So if you can wrap your head around like a slight bit of nuance, which is to say there are things we can learn from the Cold War, but that we can't overlearn those lessons, and that the use of the term Cold War has been weaponized in a sense to attack people who want to confront the China challenge. If you can keep those three ideas in your head, then we could have a discussion about what we can take from the Cold War and why it's also not the model for what we're seeing exactly.
In the minds of the government, of the administration officials in early 19, are events from 2018 that are not easily put together, but we can see them more clearly now. Let's begin with the demand by China that the word Taiwan be erased from airline websites, or the demand by China that Marriott fire one of its employees because he's used the word Taiwan, or the demand by China with these all strange remarks that the NBA interfere in the freedom of an American to speak out because that American has in some fashion shown support for the people of Hong Kong. These were incidents in everybody's mind in 2018. You've mentioned the Uyghurs already. Now, Josh, that's not Cold War thinking, but it's strange. Was there anyone organizing the fact that China is now telling us that our First Amendment is to be circumscribed because China demands it? Did they understand in Washington that China is no longer satisfied with its territorial integrity? It's going to edit the Constitution of the United States.
Well, that's exactly right. It's been dawning on various parts of American society quite slowly that China's efforts to control discussion about its actions are now extended way beyond its borders. And in China, they call this a social credit system. And that's not to say that, you lose social credit for breaking the law. You lose social credit for going against the party, going against the party's political agenda. And Chinese people have been dealing with that for a long time. And what happened in 2018, but more actually in 2019, especially with the NBA case, was that China started to enforce that against American companies and American citizens and American companies, not knowing what to do and not having any real experience or guidance in how to fight the Chinese Communist Party's economic coercion, did pretty much the same thing each time, which is to fold and bow and scrape and beg for forgiveness and promise never to do it again. And when the U.S. government was sort of getting involved in these issues, especially with the NBA, what it would often do is to criticize the American companies. But, sort of what I argue in the book is that these companies were victims of the Chinese Communist Party's coercion tactics and that they didn't really have any idea or any resources to confront or protect themselves. So, we have this sort of awareness now that, oh, wait, when the Chinese government punishes the NBA for one tweet and the punishment is in the hundreds of millions of dollars, something's wrong there, right? Most Americans can sort of look at that and say, oh, my God, like, we can't have that. We can't have the Chinese Communist Party telling us what not to tweet, and they're going to, punish an entire industry over it. At the same time, the U.S. government really hasn't come through with any good solutions or any real partnerships. So I think that's a huge gap in our policy. But the fact is that when the Chinese Communist Party starts exporting its punishments, that sort of puts the lie to the argument that it's not trying to enforce its ideology.
The Confucius Societies, the Confucius Clubs. In 2019, I believe, Josh, you at George Washington University, your alma mater, you join a Confucius Institute-sponsored Chinese language class, and you discover that you're not being influenced. But the Confucius Societies, how do they function on American campuses at that time?
Right. And again, this is a case-by-case issue that's very difficult to talk about, much less confront. And when I joined the GW Confucius Institute Chinese class, there were just a bunch of people learning Chinese, and I didn't witness any malign influence activities. But at the same time, as I was reporting on this issue, I got calls from, people in different schools, FBI agents, professors, students, who actually did see very clear examples of these institutes being abused for the purposes of Chinese Communist Party influence advancement in a number of ways. And some, in Washington, D.C., it's you don't really need to use the Confucius Institute to do your espionage. But in a place like Western Florida, for example, well, that's a place where, the Confucius Institute becomes a really good place to hide a couple of spies. And then, in other campuses, like in UC San Diego, well, they just protest against the Dalai Lama coming until the Dalai Lama can never come to your school again. And, there's a range of different ways that student organizations on campus are used and abused by their local consulates and by the Chinese government to shut down the freedom of speech for Chinese students on campus and for American students on campus. And again, that's not to say that we shouldn't celebrate Chinese student organizations, but we also have to be clear-eyed about when they're being abused and when they're being funded by, Communist Party influence organizations. And it happens all the time, as it turns out.
You make the very helpful point that U.S. institutions are accustomed to being independent, not seeking Washington's help. Did they come to understand at the time that there was a common a theme here and that they needed something larger? Did they call the FBI?
Right. Well, this is the same thing we saw with the NBA and the same thing I've seen with the Wall Street firms. And this is really one of the main themes of the book is that, when the FBI comes knocking on your door, that's not always the best interaction for if you're a university or a Silicon Valley tech company or a Wall Street firm. And the distrust between the U.S. government and a lot of American institutions, parts of American society, is like well established and well earned. And we can't do what the Chinese side does, which is, you know, the government or the party comes in, they tell everybody what to do, and everybody just does it. Our system doesn't work that way. So, you know, I think that, you know, over time, again, mistakes have been made, but the national security community and academia have started to work constructively on how to deal with this common problem. And in Silicon Valley, it hasn't gone that well, and in Wall Street, it's gone even worse. And, you know, some of it is that these institutions rightly protect their independence, and some of it is that some of those elites are compromised or corrupt, and it's hard to know which is which. And it's also true that when the FBI gets involved, they don't always do it perfectly, you know, and the mistakes are made. So this is all part of the awakening that we all have to sort of get our heads together on, which is that, you know, the presence of malign foreign influence in our institutions is a shared problem, and we have to come up with some shared solutions that don't go overboard and that don't target Chinese or Chinese Americans disproportionately, but that at the same time, we can't ignore this problem anymore because it's showing up everywhere we look.
The book is Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. Josh Rogan is the author. When we come back, Josh mentions Wall Street, but there's much to learn about how Wall Street has a mixed record towards investment in China. Also, what is the Thousand Talent Plan? I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, and I'm very pleased to continue my conversation with Josh Rogan of the Washington Post, whose new book is Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. Josh helps us to identify the whole-of-society approach that the People's Republic of China was taking to influence, that's a generous diplomatic word, decisions made by politicians and voters in the United States towards the People's Republic, which is declared very clearly to the Obama administration, to the Trump administration, and will continue to declare into the future, our integrity, territorial integrity, our sovereignty will not be challenged, will not be challenged. However, they come here to undermine our understanding of our sovereignty, of our integrity. All right, fine. How do they do that? Josh, first, before we go to Wall Street, what is the Thousand Talent Plan? What was it?
Well, the Thousand Talents Program is just one, the largest one, but only one of over 200 talent recruitment programs that the Chinese Communist Party runs to attract foreign scientists, academics, and researchers to contribute to their system. Now, there's a part of that that's overt and public, but there's a big part of it that's covert and secret, and that's the part that the U.S. government has started to crack down on, mostly in 2018 and 2019, and still continues to this day. And basically what the U.S. government kept finding was that, you know, American researchers had been paid enormous sums of money to secretly take non-public research from their American institutions and hand it over to their Chinese counterparts. And, you know, this is against the law in many cases, especially when you're talking about American funding of this research, but it's also just sort of crazy when you think about it because, you know, we had this entire scientific community that's sort of very integrated, and we'd always valued that integration, and then we found out, or it slowly became obvious, that the Chinese side was abusing that integration and abusing that engagement to steal huge amounts of scientific knowledge, again, before it was public, in order to capitalize on it for both military and economic purposes, and that problem remains to this day.
Big tech. You name Apple, Google, I'm sure we could go down the list. You also talk about the Secretary of the Treasury, the tech sector, and then there are the chip makers. Josh, is it your measure that these large entities, Apple being, I think, the largest on the planet, understood that in trading with China, they were taking risks on a daily basis of compromise?
Yeah, I mean, different tech giants have different levels of exposure. Apple has the most exposure because it's the most dependent on the Chinese market and most dependent on Chinese laborers. So it's a textbook story of when a country just becomes a hostage to the Chinese Communist Party, and then the Chinese Communist Party starts to put on the squeeze. And first, they demand that you move all your servers inside China, which basically undermines all of your users' privacy. Then next, they come and demand that you take Hong Kong apps off of the App Store. And the next thing you know, they're telling you to, you know, pretend that Taiwan is not its own country in all of your websites. And before you know it, you're just doing the thing of the Chinese Communist Party. That's a bind that Apple finds itself in for which there is no clear solution. You know, other companies have all sorts of different approaches. Google exited China in 2010 when they realized that they were getting thoroughly hacked, and then slowly but surely started to dip its toe back in, eventually establishing an artificial intelligence center in China and, you know, with a Chinese company. And there's some sort of understanding amongst all of these tech executives that there's going to be some level of theft, right? That doing business in China, you're going to lose some of your IP. You're going to be forced into some sort of joint venture where they rob you blind. But if you can make enough money and get enough scientific benefit out of it, the cost benefit might work in that analysis for as far as it goes. But what happened in 2019 and 2018, to some degree, was that the national security community started coming to these tech companies and saying to them, do you realize what you're doing? Do you understand that this cooperation is not only undermining U.S. national security, but you're contributing to, making yourselves complicit in atrocities, and you're undermining our broader, you know, goals as a country and as an economy. And that also did not always go well. And, you know, then you had companies like Facebook who saw the Chinese tech industry coming for them and switched sides. In the middle of 2019, Mark Zuckerberg switched from trying to get into China to trying to compete with China, because he realized that it was no longer an issue of him penetrating the Chinese market. It was an issue of TikTok penetrating the U.S. market. And all of a sudden, the Chinese had the first mover advantage. And all of this time, President Trump is lording over these debates, you know, quite incompetently. And at times when he appoints people like Steve Mnuchin to negotiate with them, all of the incentives get mixed, and all of the Wall Street incentives and the tech incentives and the national security incentives start to clash in ways that nobody can control. So that's a real mess that someone eventually is going to have to untangle.
Wall Street, the investor class, those responsible for large funds, CalPERS, you identify one of them. Do they have an easy, or do they have a straightforward, or do they have a plan at all to disentangle themselves from investing and providing capital to bad actors in China?
Well, quite the opposite. And what I document pretty extensively into the book, and this happens especially at the end of 2019 and into 2020, is that the Wall Street executives actually have the opposite goal. Their goal is to integrate the economies as much as possible to get out ahead of these crazy national security guys who want some sort of decoupling. And the way that they do that is very savvy. First of all, if you look at the Phase One trade deal, it actually is very focused on opening up financial markets for Wall Street firms inside China. It was a huge, huge win for them. And then as the national security people start to knock on all these doors in Wall Street and say, hey, do you realize that you're putting hundreds of millions of dollars of Americans' retirement funds, investor funds, and you're directing them towards Chinese companies that are building the missiles that are pointed at us and building the concentration camps that are committing genocide? And do you care about that? And do you realize that that's a material risk? One by one, these Wall Street firms either said, you're wrong, you want a Cold War, you know, or go to hell, you know. And so that's actually the bleeding edge of the China competition, so to speak. That's what the fight that's going on right now is. Wall Street, to an enormous degree, is very much resisting this idea that putting American investment into malign Chinese companies is something that we need to avoid. At the same time, it's becoming increasingly obvious, especially when you look at places like Hong Kong, that there's a huge risk in putting your money into these Chinese companies, because these Chinese companies, just look at Jack Ma's company for an example, don't actually operate on free market principles, and they're all liable to get snuffed out by the Chinese Communist Party at any moment for any reason.
Josh Rogan is the author of Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. We turn now to 2020 and the virus. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show with Josh Rogan of the Washington Post, the Global Opinions columnist. Most importantly, right now, the author of the new book, Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. This is a story of 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20 that much establishes what we know and don't know about the pandemic, about the threat to national security here and with our allies, and the threat to planet Earth right now, what we know and what we don't know. There are ironies aplenty here, because Josh is telling the story of the Trump policy towards China, with China, that was looking to, in some way, resolve itself in January of 2020, the Phase One trade deal. History is not neat, and it can be one thing after another. On the 15th, that Phase One deal, with handshakes all around, is sealed in Washington. And the Chinese negotiators get on the plane to go home to Beijing. The day before, however, at the National Security Council meeting, at the the National Security Council meeting at the Policy Coordination Committee level, that is, the principals were not there, the coordinators were there, there was a report of a strange new flu from China. And one of the people attending that meeting is Matthew Pottinger. We've met him before. What did they know on January 14th about this flu, Josh? Because I mentioned that I had spoken of that flu on January 6th to my colleague Gordon Chang when we did a show that night. It was reported out of the South China Morning Post as an unusual flu described as pneumonia-like. What did they know on the 14th?
Well, not much. And you have to remember that, you know, at this point, the Chinese delegation is in town to sign this trade deal. After 3 years of contention, and the President of the United States, Donald Trump, gets up at the podium and he says, this will be a new era of U.S.-China relations where, you know, we're all going to be friends and it's going to be wonderful. And at the same exact time, the national security people are meeting about this new strange flu that's spreading in Wuhan, and they don't know anything. The Chinese delegation didn't say a word. They just got on the plane and left. Never mentioned it, okay? And if you could imagine what's going on inside the White House at this moment, they're so proud and they're so happy and they're expecting this trade deal to be the thing that they're going to run on, and that's going to get the president reelected, and the U.S.-China relationship has to be good in order for that all to work. And then here comes, you know, a little these national security guys, including Matt Pottinger, to tell them, wait a second, we got a problem here. And we're getting more information. We don't know exactly what it is, but we think we might have to shut down travel from China. And as you can imagine, people like Mick Mulvaney, the White House Chief of Staff, and Steve Mnuchin were like, oh, my God, we can't do that.
That's all right, let's go to the days. These days of January are critical because we know things now we didn't know then. So I want to take us to that moment. The 14th, they have a policy coordination committee level meeting. Pottinger attends.
Right, and nobody knows it.
Pottinger on the 24th goes to a bingo club meeting, a bingo club event. What he hears anecdotally, frightens him. Now, I remember hearing anecdotally on the 25th, the next day, from an informant out of China. Something was going on at Wuhan. Pottinger, of course, had the power to act on it, and immediately he tells his boss, now National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, on the 27th, Monday to the 27th, to get a cabinet meeting put together and to inform everybody that something bad is happening in China. What did they know at that point on the 27th? This is late January.
Right. So Matt Pottinger had talked to his sources from his time covering the SARS epidemic. They told him that there was asymptomatic spread and that the Chinese government was covering it up. These were doctors inside China who knew what they were talking about, who were reliable. His wife is a virologist. His brother is an epidemiologist. He was reading the Chinese social media in Chinese. He was reading the intelligence streams, and he was trying to sound the alarms, and nobody would listen. And when he convened that meeting on January 25th, he said to all of the principals, the top guys, he said, tell me why we shouldn't shut down travel from China. And they had various reasons, and Trump refused to do it until the next day. Then Pottinger and O'Brien went into Trump and they said, this is the biggest national security crisis of your presidency. It's unfolding now. It's going to be like 1918, and you better get on it.
This is Tuesday, January 28th in the Oval Office. O'Brien, Pottinger, and the president. Go ahead, Josh.
Yes, and on that same day, the first case of community spread was detected in the United States. That's when the health officials in the United States government switched over and supported the ban. That's when 2 days later, Trump instituted the China travel ban, and we were off to the races. But even at that time, people like Mick Mulvaney and Steve Mnuchin were telling the president that this was reckless, that he shouldn't do this, that he was going to wreck the economy and wreck his reelection chances. And he had another voice in his ear on February 6th. Chinese President Xi Jinping told the president a lot of lies about the coronavirus, including that it would go away in warm weather, that it could be treated with herbal medicine, that they had it under control in China. And none of these things were true, but they added to the garble that was going on inside the president's head, and that's what added to the garble that came out in our policy at the time. So as much information as people like Pottinger and O'Brien could throw at the president, he still trusted his good friend Xi Jinping, much to the chagrin of the national security people and much to the detriment of our national public health.
We're watching the politics of this emerge. I understand there's this large distinction made today between the science and the politics. They're all mixed up here because the political voices were not getting good science. They were not getting good facts out of China. And that was initially the problem and continues the problem, Josh. Nothing has changed. China wasn't naming correctly what was happening. And therefore,
worse than that.
Go ahead.
They were hiding the facts. They were disappearing the people who were communicating true information. When they got scientific information, they kept it from the world. There's allegations that they manipulated the scientists to point blame away from one of the theories that there was human error involved in the outbreak related to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, the world's largest bat coronavirus research center in the world. And that pattern of obfuscation and, you know, silencing journalists and silencing scientists continues to this day. And, you know, this became, as you rightly pointed out, hyper-politicized in the United States because everything related to Trump and Pompeo was hyper-politicized. But if you take the politics out of it just for a second, you will see that the behavior of the Chinese leadership, especially with regard to the origin story, but also with regard to how the virus was spreading in real time and their lies and cover-ups, had a direct effect on the
Thursday, February 6th. It's always good in an opera to get the principals involved. You understand. All right. Don Giovanni talking to Don Giovanni. February 6th, President Trump is on the phone with President Xi. A lengthy telephone conversation is how the White House characterized it. You get the readout on February 9th. Was the virus discussed in a fashion that Trump could have understood that Xi was being candid about?
Trump thought Xi was being candid, but the Chinese president was actually lying to the United States president. And that was only the beginning of the misdirection that the Chinese president pointed at Trump for months and months and months. And, you know, it fed into Trump's desire to want to play down the virus. At the same time, he was getting conflicting information from his own officials. He didn't want it to be bad, and President Xi knew how to manipulate the President of the United States in order to convince him that it wouldn't be bad. And that was very much in the interest of the Chinese government, but not in the interest of our response. And then what came after that is that the Chinese government threatened and blackmailed U.S. officials and told them to shut up about China's handling of the virus if they wanted their masks, if they wanted their PPE. And because the United States in its time of worst suffering was dependent on shipments from China, the U.S. diplomats were, and the U.S. State Department was caught in that dilemma of how to handle this very delicate situation. And of course, that wasn't just the United States. That was every country in the world. And China had the most influence, the most power, because it was the first mover and because it had the most masks and the most science. But if you think about it, this was a huge opportunity for the Chinese Communist Party to show what it would be like as a world leader. And they did sort of show what it would be like. And it wasn't a pretty picture.
The virus, where did it come from? Josh has a chapter devoted to what we know now about the virus, where it came from, what it's associated with. And when we come back, the few details we have suggest we need many, many more details in the course of time. To name the thing correctly is to lead to affairs that can be carried with success. We have not named the thing correctly. Josh Rogan. The book is Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. Josh Rogan of The Washington Post. His new book is Chaos Under Heaven, Trump, Xi, and the Battle for the 21st Century. It is the spring of 2020, just yesterday. And the expectation is that the virus can be dealt with in some fashion in time. A vaccine, careful safety mechanisms, a marshaling of the population of the United States, of the population of Europe, of all continents, to prevent the spread of the virus enough so that health facilities can care for those who are very ill. The vulnerable are over 60 or over 50, have the pre-existing conditions. We know all this. But still, it is necessary to name the thing correctly, as Confucius tells us. Where did the virus come from? How did it suddenly show itself in Wuhan? One theory advanced by the Chinese is that it was natural, out of jumping from one species to another, perhaps bats to pangolin and then to mankind, who would consume the pangolin. Another theory advanced by the Chinese soon after the revelations of the catastrophe in Wuhan was that it was spread by the United States military. It was fantastic at the time, and it was puzzling, but it was a theory. Another approach was a lab accident. Josh spends a deal of time pulling together what we know so far about the lab accident thinking. It happens. And the lab, the Wuhan WIV, the Wuhan lab, was identified as early as 2017 of having security problems or not being well taken care of. It had two level three labs, and one level four lab. Josh, if I say this incorrectly, help me. The level four lab is the one that was important. What do we know about that lab, and what don't we know?
Well, as you rightly pointed out, in 2017, 4 years ago, U.S. diplomats traveled to the Wuhan Institute of Virology, the world's leading coronavirus research center, met with the scientists there and wrote two cables back to Washington warning that their new level four lab was woefully insufficient in terms of its safety and staffing procedures and resources. But more specifically, they warned that this lab had shown that it was doing risky coronavirus research on bats and how they could affect human beings. And that research had been published, although little noticed at the time. And what these diplomats wrote back to Washington was that, hey, listen, they're doing risky bat coronavirus research, and we think it might be posing a direct danger to humans if a lab accident were to occur and they have these safety concerns. We should probably do something about it. And those warnings were totally ignored back in Washington. Now, when the outbreak occurred in Wuhan, these same diplomats thought to themselves, wow, isn't this exactly the same thing that we were warning about? And they tried to raise the alarm again. But by the time this had happened, the story of the origin of the coronavirus had become so highly politicized by all sides that it was very hard for them to get any attention once again. And the reason it became very politicized was twofold. One, because the Chinese government put out a story that this had originated in a seafood market in Wuhan. They later disavowed that story and sanitized the market before that, and the evidence could be preserved that would have proven that story. But at that time, that was the official Chinese government story. Administration asserted, after I published those cables from those very diplomats, that they believed that the lab was involved and that they believed that the lab accident had been responsible for the outbreak. But they didn't provide the evidence to support that either. So most people in the media in Washington and in the country were forced to choose between believing the Chinese government's, you know, unproven assertion or the Trump administration's unproven assertion. And basically everyone's scientific analysis fell down along those political lines. And then the story got corrupted even further when they assigned to do the investigation some of the Western scientists who had been the best friends of the people who were running the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And they had a clear conflict of interest. And to this day, they seem to be steering the WHO investigation against any real inspection of the lab. And so that just shows you how, as you said earlier, the science and the politics are becoming mixed up in all sorts of weird and corrupt ways that we have find it very hard to untangle. And what I tried to do very simply in the book was to argue that, you know, first of all, we don't know how the origin story began. We don't know how the virus broke out. But we need to investigate all of the possible theories, including the natural spillover theory, including the lab accident theory, and see where the science and data takes us. Simple as that, full stop. And that investigation right now is impossible because the Chinese government won't allow it. But also that investigation happens to be exactly what the Biden administration is pushing for, because they're not invested in one theory one way or the other. Neither should any of us be. And we should just, you know, realize the fact that, you know, this lab, this Wuhan Institute of Virology, was conducting risky experiments on bat coronaviruses and how they infect humans. That doesn't mean it was a bioweapon. That just means there might have been some human error that related to the outbreak.
You have a quote from Richard E. Bright, a microbiologist and biosafety expert at Rutgers University. If SARS-CoV-2, that's COVID-19, arose from gain-of-function research in a lab, it is entirely plausible, even likely, that an animal model involved in that work would have been humanized ACE2 mice. There is clear plausibility. There is not evidence. To get evidence would require either a confession or an investigation. Rather than explain what an ACE2 mice are, I'm going to say that Mr. Ebright is setting up the challenge for the future. That's what we need, Josh. We need an answer to the question he raised, and we need a confession or a full investigation of the facts. And as of yet, do I say correctly, that has not happened?
No, and there's no prospect of it happening because of the Chinese government's ongoing cover-up and refusal to answer basic questions about what was going on in Wuhan at that time. And, you know, it's pretty shocking. The data that they are hiding could help us understand the outbreak. They clearly don't want to help us do that. You know, what Ebright is saying is that, you know, what they were doing was they were taking naturally occurring viruses that they had found in Yunnan, by the way, which is 1,000 miles away from Wuhan, right? The thing that you have to sort of wrap your head around is that the bats who had these types of viruses came from 1,000 miles away from the outbreak, but they broke out 10 miles away from the lab which was researching these viruses. What he's saying is that they weren't engineered per se. It's not as if a scientist went in and tinkered with them. What they do is they pass them back and forth through mice, and the mice have human lung cells that they've specifically implanted in them, and that speeds up the evolution. That speeds up the process by which these viruses become more dangerous. That's the point of the research. The point of the research is to speed up these viruses' evolution to figure out how they might turn into pandemics. And it's at the height of irony that this exact research to predict the pandemic might have actually spawned the pandemic. But if you think about what they were doing, well, then it makes a lot of sense, and it's definitely worth a closer look that we right now can't have.
In 2004, you were a very young China hand. In 2016, you were a middle-aged China hand. At the close of your book, you make the very clear statement that the China challenge will last for a generation. So when you're my age, Josh, some 30 or 40 years from now, can we expect that this confrontation will have been solved, or is it a spiral? How do the people who think about this professionally, how did Matt Pottinger and Robert O'Brien think about it? Are we in an end game where we're going to collide, or are we going to find a way out together?
Well, what I'm describing there is a generational turnover, and I think that generational turnover is happening right now. And the older generation of Asian hands believe that roughly open engagement with China would lead to China liberalizing economically and politically, and that would solve all of our other problems. And the younger generation of Asian hands, not so young anymore, never believed that. And they saw China for what it was, not for what the older generation said it was or wanted it to become. And what that means is that we're at the beginning, the first inning of a much longer game. And we don't know how this will end, but we know what our goal should be. Our goal should be to establish a relationship between China and the rest of the world that both sides can live with, to avoid the conflict that neither side seeks. And what that means essentially is to convince the Chinese leadership that it has, its behavior outside of its borders has to change, and that its rise cannot come at the expense of the security, prosperity, and public health of our citizens. And suffice to say, they don't seem convinced yet. And so that's what the Trump administration did. They played the first inning of that new game, for better or worse. And now the Biden administration has to continue where they left off and hopefully devise a strategy that partners and allies and all Americans can rally around, because this is the challenge of our generation. And the point is to avoid conflict, but that cannot happen by hoping that the problem goes away, because hope is not a strategy.
Josh Rogan is the Washington Post columnist. He writes global opinions. He reports on China routinely, has over the years. He's been my guide for that reporting. His new book, Chaos Under Heaven, is a chronology of the Trump years from the election, actually a week before the election, 2016, through the first year, the trade identifying how we can trade together and how a better deal can be achieved. The second year, when suddenly for the first time there's clearly a trade war underway, to the third and fourth years where we distrust each other profoundly. I'm John Batchelor.
Are you a fraud-paying American? One in four tax-paying Americans has been a victim of identity fraud. With LifeLock, if your identity is stolen, they fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Last year, billions in refunds were stolen. Could be from your salary, overtime, or second job. Gone. But this year, you don't need to stay a victim. Because this tax season, fraud-paying American is something no American should have to claim. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
When Kohler, global design leader in luxurious kitchen and bath products, asked me to be their ambassador for timeless, elegant, durable cast iron, I said, I'm in. Soon after, I was in their Kohler, Wisconsin foundry, watching molten iron poured, enamel applied by hand, and the beautiful finished pieces ready to ship. Since 1883, Kohler cast iron has been crafted by incredible artisans, and seeing it firsthand gave me a whole new appreciation for their craftsmanship. Now, I'm proud to lend my stamp of approval to my favorite Kohler cast iron products for their durability, beauty, and enduring style. Shop my curated picks at Kohler.com. As the Kohler cast iron ambassador, I say, long live cast iron.